Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Lessons with Leaders, a special edition of Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Lori Siebert. Our producer tonight is Neil Heaver. This is Lessons with Leaders, a show where we have the opportunity to understand what makes the Lehigh Valley great and the leaders and people who get us there. We want to understand what drives them, lessons they would like to share, and why they call the Lehigh Valley home. My guest this evening is Mike Gosling. Mike graduated from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute with a B.S. in Mechanical Engineering in 1980, and he received an MBA in Finance from Miami University of Ohio in 1983. Mike has one son and two German Shepherds. In his spare time, he enjoys golfing, biking, hiking, philanthropic activities, red wines in Asheville, North Carolina. He's active in the local community, supporting a wide range of economic development and entrepreneurial ventures, which we will cover as we go through the show. What Mike Gosling is most known for is co-founder and former CEO of OraSure Technologies, where he helped the company from a startup to more than $50 million in annual sales. The company was best known for developing and securing FDA approval for the first rapid oral fluid HIV test in the world. Mike is a co-founder and managing partner of Originate Ventures, LLC. Originate is a venture capital investment firm which invests in early stage and emerging growth technology companies in eastern Pennsylvania. Mike led the efforts to raise $46 million to start the venture fund. Since its inception in 2007, the fund has invested more than $40 million in 17 early stage technology companies. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lori.
Thank you for coming. Let's start at the beginning, Mike. Can you tell us a bit about where you grew up and how you landed in the Lehigh Valley?
Sure. I was born in Cincinnati, Ohio in January of 1959. So those trying to do the math, that puts me at 59 years old as of last week. I was raised in Middletown, Ohio. For steel buffs, that was Armco Steel. So my dad was a steel worker with more than 35 years at Armco Steel. I was one of five children, the oldest, and my mom stayed at home. I was both grade school and high school. I went to Catholic schools before I went to RPI for my mechanical engineering degree.
And what brought you to go into mechanical engineering and move away from home then?
If you asked me sophomore year in high school, I wanted an engineering degree and an MBA in finance, and I wanted to run a medium-sized company someday. I've always been on a 5 to 10 year plan. So my math scores, you know, were great scores on SATs, and it said engineering. So I seek to get in the best engineering school on the planet I could get in and go for it.
Well, that certainly helped with your eventual startup skills that you've seem to have taken a leaning towards. So take us through the early days of your startup and some of the experiences through that process that impacted your leadership skills.
Well, let's back up just a little bit to sort of what I kind of, that was sort of this lost skill set that I had, because when you went to college and you got out of college, the training that we all had was go to work for a large corporation, do the best that you can, and retire there with as good a pension as you possibly can. And so that was sort of how I was trained as a child, and then when we went to college. And I followed that conventional path I thought that I would be a plant manager of a medium-sized company. But I got my training at Procter & Gamble, and an amazing company that taught you how to, you know, make the best products for people, which warranted a premium brand positioning and a premium price because, you know, frankly, you know, what's better than Pampers for your child at that time? But what was latently back there, and it wasn't a term back in 1986, was, you know, sort of entrepreneurship. And if you looked at my life from getting my first job in fourth grade to buy my first pair of Converse tennis shoes, I was always hustling with a job on the side to do whatever I wanted, including paying my own way to go to college. If you want to go to college, because we can't afford for you to go to college with the five kids at home. So I always had a side venture going on that helped me pay the bills. And so when there was an opportunity with the idea of putting a sunscreen product on a tablet delivery system, single application, cover your face, neck, arms, and legs, and throw it away, I thought it was a great idea, and I took it to my boss at Procter & Gamble, and I said, what do you think of this? And I'd been promoted 5 times in 5 years on a fast track, loved what I did, loved the company, showed this idea just with the idea that I would get feedback from my mentor, and he truly was my mentor, and he was on a fast track, that this is all well and good, but, you know, you're happy here, and let those crazy people do whatever they do. And surprisingly to me, my mentor's name was John. John said, Mike, you're 29 and single. You're going to do great wherever you go. I have golden handcuffs. And he goes, before you get too far along and, you know, you're a single guy, you're crazy if you don't give this a try. You'll regret it the rest of your life. So, you know, at that point, the guy from a business perspective I trusted most in life that had my best interest told me I was crazy if I didn't leave to go be an entrepreneur. So with that guidance, I left.
Well, this is interesting because what I'm already sensing, I feel a lot of energy from you, a lot of passion, a lot of ideas. You did land at, I think, what could have been a great launching pad, Procter & Gamble. They do give people project management skills, but the ability to run with something. So how did that ability to run with that idea turn into doing it on your own? What did that feel like? What did it take inside of you, even with that mentor? So we're going to talk about how people probably have influenced you through your life, and that could have been one of those first person outside of your family who influenced you. But how did, what spirit did it take for you to say, you know what, he's right, I'm going to go do it?
There's this, I've been accused of this most of my adult life of ready, fire, aim, instead of ready, aim, fire. And I, in a lot of business classes, I call it, you know, textbook business strategy 101. And I fail miserably because I'm a ready, fire, aim guy. Entrepreneurs, you know, on limited information with lots of gut call and, you know, you run the analytics in your head. But my boss at Procter & Gamble, one of the most profound things to me, that he ever said to me that I use in my own mind, he says, Mike, you get to 90% of the solution in 10% of the time, and the organization strangles you on that last 10% when it never matters. So I work by the 90-10 rule that says, intuitively, I'm going to get to 90% of the solution in 10% of the time. Go for it. And if you make any mistakes, admit it, regroup, and then start back over with the 90-10 rule.
Great. So there was some intuition around this. So now you have this product. Is that what became your first startup?
It wasn't my startup. And I'm going to emphasize this throughout, if I'm going to be fair to my whole, you know, what is defined as success. I've been part of a we all my adult life since I've left. And I left to come here because one of my other partners, Bill Hinchey, had an original idea as a graduate school project at Carnegie Mellon. And we happened to work at the same division of Procter & Gamble. And he came to me, and over pizza and beer, he said, you know, everybody tells me if there's a finance guy to look at a new project idea that sort of thinks outside the box, it's you. So he was already resigning to start the business, and he had met Sam Nedbala, who had been a Lehigh University graduate. So I'm going to start, you know, connecting some dots of how we ended up from Ohio to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and to Lehigh University, and the Ben Franklin program specifically, is that Bill recruited or found a PhD chemist that could formulate a sunscreen product after he graduated from graduate school. And he was disappointed that he couldn't pursue that and had come to Procter & Gamble. But it was a latent desire to leave. I was just a guy that looked at the business plan that sort of suggested some things to make it a better idea. And he left to go start it with Sam. Bill and Sam did, and one other partner at the time. And they found the incubator at Lehigh University because Sam had got his master's and PhD here. I came on a month later. Bill came back and said, you have engineering skills, you're a finance guy, we don't have that on our team. Would you ever consider joining us? And I'm going, well, I just got promoted again, I love what I do. And then I went and saw my boss and he suggested I leave, and so that darn 90-10 rule got in the way.
And so you had to love what you do. So how did they convince you that you were going to love what you were going to be doing?
They were as clueless as I was, to be fair. I mean, none of us had any idea what we were really getting ourselves into, but there was a passion around the idea of putting a sunscreen product on a towelette delivery system. And I'm going to show my age at this point, but I do it with students to say, does anybody know what the logo is, you know, for Coppertone? Students who generally haven't been born at that point can say that, oh, well, that's the dog pulling the diaper down on the baby. And I said, if you've really, you know, go where that logo came from, that's because when we were children and you were going to the beach, you lathered them up with Hawaiian Tropic number 3 oil and bronzed them. You know, today you'd go to jail for that. But back then, and the logo still persists, that there at that time, everything was deep, dark tan, beach, and pool. So this is all about highly differentiated products in an emerging market. And we'll talk all through this of where I am as an entrepreneur is what's really fun in a leadership model is taking the unknown, the high risk, and then kind of categorically, like our venture fund says, is give me an emerging technology and a highly differentiated category with a good leadership team and an early adopter in place. And if you got those four variables, let's just go for it. And if you go backwards to our first sunscreen product, it was beach and pool, and we had sun protection. Everything was beach and pool. We went sports and recreation. You had a very large category, you know, dominated by one player called Coppertone. So we had all the differentiating factors. The only thing missing was the leadership team. And three, you know, pent-up entrepreneurs that thought they had a great idea, had enough passion to, who didn't know each other, to move to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania and just go for it. And, you know, there's no other word but clueless of what we were getting ourselves into.
So how did Lehigh University's Ben Franklin Institute help in that regard?
Help? That's an understatement. It's a four-letter word. It was an amazing facility. It was one of the first in the country, Pennsylvania, taking on incubator facilities. There was nothing like that in Cincinnati, or we would have stayed in Cincinnati. And you chase the money sometimes, and we chased the money. And we chased a location that was closer to Sam. Sam was in New Jersey working for a large corporation. We were in Ohio. We were single guys. And there was this incubator for startups. It was 2 years old, and they had space, and we had the energy level, and, you know, timing was perfect to give us some space and a little bit of capital to get started. So we packed up, our cars and separately and moved to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. I told my parents when I moved and I'd quit my job at Procter & Gamble, I asked them if I could store my stuff in the garage. I said, because, you know, Wall Street Journal, I read an article that says, you know, 95% of businesses that are started don't make it through the first year. Of those 5% that actually make it through the first year, only 1% of those ever get to $1 million in revenues. And it's likely that a year from now, I'm going to have to get my stuff out of the garage. And can I keep it there, number one? And number two, I just got to try this. And I was repeating what my boss had told me, because if you don't do it, you'll always look back and regret that you never gave it a shot.
Well, you just mentioned a couple, I think, very poignant pieces of information. Is number one, you weren't so delusionary to think that you were definitely going to be successful. So here you are with these entrepreneurial skills, but with a sense of common sense and practicality about it as well, that it might not work, but you had so much passion around it that you were certainly going in with both feet and hoping that it would work. But I think sometimes there could be...
Can I interrupt there for a second?
Sure.
Sure. Delusional was the right word, because basically everyone said, you have a great paying job, you're rising in a large corporation, and you're going to give that all up and not pay yourself for 3 years and deliver phone books and live off credit cards. Now, it wasn't anything more than delusional for the first 3 years. It sounded like a really stupid thing I did on impulse. And fortunately, I had partners that had the same survival, blue collar, grind it out, too proud to give up, driven by a handful of amazing moments during that first 2 years that kept this going, and it wasn't money.
Right.
This is not, you know, we firmly believed in our product, but it was everyone basically saying, you're crazy and you've lost your mind. So the delusional part sort of overrode, and the grinding part overrode. Survivor was in place, but what we did get is positive feedback that were good things. Bob Barker on The Price is Right had our product on the show. Cost us $1,000 to reach whatever the number was, you know, 5 million people that watched the show, and this was in our first 6 months. So it's tape show. We watch it, don't know what's going to happen, and lo and behold, there's a woman comes up, and I may not have my facts right, but, you know, it's taken on legendary status at this point. But, you know, she had to pick three products out of, you know, five that were under $5, and if she did, she'd win $25,000. So we got 6 seconds, you know, SunSense towelettes, single application, cover your face, neck, arms, and legs, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And we're high-fiving each other, cheering each other, because we are on Bob Barker. Described our product, described the other four. She picked two of them correctly, and she came back and asked for our product to be described again. Described again, we get our 6 more seconds. We're high-fiving. My partner, who's got the marketing background, Bill, is saying, look, I got twice the impact for my dollars. She picked our product. She won $25,000. We lived off the next year off the energy of Bob Barker announcing our product and then a woman winning. That was saying we were doing the right thing. Wall Street Journal wrote us up on Friday the 13th. Startup guys, ex-Procter & Gamble guys, we've seen LensCrafter start out of the same division as these guys 2 years before them. Big idea. You got to give people that come out of Procter with that kind of training a chance. And oh, by the way, the world's changing and you can't just lather your child up anymore. Stuff's happening. And we got written up on the Wall Street Journal, and we must have felt like a million copies of that. And in our minds, it was validation during delirious times that it was all okay.
And when you think about it, it's those moments that end up carrying you through the 3 years of not always being sure, not knowing where this might be going, other than with your passion, your drive, your hard work. Those moments are really what help keep you going. So for people who are listening, and we're talking about lessons with leaders, when we hear these stories, and quite often people forget about the journey that so many successful people have, and when we're talking about leaders, typically we're talking about people who have been successful, but quite often people forget about the journey through it all. So you have described a great piece of your journey from childhood up through going to college, paying your own way. I come from that background as well. That does make a difference, and that does help shape you in the ongoing work ethic that you have and carrying on your life with passion, but understanding that there's moments and it's not always just the glory at the end. Folks, we are talking with Mike Gosling, former co-founder and CEO of Orisure Technologies, and now currently a co-founder and managing partner of Originate Ventures. We're talking about lessons with leaders, and we're fortunate to have Mike here with us discussing his story and where it has been, where it is, and where it's going. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion and we'll learn more about the Orisure story with Mike Gosling. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY is throwing a party, and you're invited. Join us for a night of live music, food, drinks, and fun as we celebrate WDIY's 22nd anniversary, featuring a performance from Steve Broski and his Big Little Band, Saturday, March 4th at the Ice House in Bethlehem. Get your tickets today at WDIY.org. We'll see you there.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture, from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Brittany, and Galicia, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, in the Lehigh Valley. Music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar every Thursday from 7 to 9 here on WDIY.
Welcome back to Lessons with Leaders. We're talking with Mike Gosling, former co-founder and CEO of Orisure Technologies, and currently a co-founder and managing partner of Originate Ventures. We're talking with Mike, getting to know his background, what he has done in the past, what he's been doing in the community recently, and what his plans are for the future. We just discussed, Mike, your background, your upbringing, all the energy that you have funneled into your entrepreneurial spirit in starting up companies. And we were talking about the Towelette company for sunscreen, which was so interesting in knowing where you are today. Tell us about the segue.
We talked about those moments in the first segment, and we had our moment, the first one written up in the Wall Street Journal. We got into 15,000 retail outlets. And again, for our readers, we'll show our age. The leading retailer in the country at that time was Kmart. Oh. Walmart was aspiring. So not only are we, you know, doing sunscreen, we're doing it with Kmart, you know, because that was the eminent player. As soon as Kmart took our product, every other retailer took it. It was a lemming theory. You got to follow the leader. So we were in 15,000 retail outlets, and we'd taken from concept to market in less than 5 months. What we really were good at as a team that sort of led us with Orisure was we were great at taking a product from concept to market. That was the true gifts of the magic between Bill, Sam, and Mike as partners was you know, us working well together to do things like that. So we'd gone from concept to market, 15,000 retail outlets. And then we licensed it worldwide to Coppertone, which had, you know, whatever, 65, 70% market share. And our deal was that we'd get 5% of royalties of anything they put on a Towelette delivery system. We had now had a global distribution channel. We could drop in sunscreens. We could drop in sports and recreation positioning because we were the first to do it. And any product they put on a Towelette delivery system, including water babies, we'd be entitled to a royalty. So we all thought we'd knocked it out of the park, and we cut the deal. And the only way I can sort of summarize what happened then is, Lori, did you see the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark?
Yes.
You know, at the end of the movie when Harrison Ford says, you know, to the government officials, who's working on, you know, where's the Ark and what's going on? And they say, we have our best government officials working on it. Right. Do you remember the last scene?
It was in a big warehouse.
Yeah, and this wasn't set up. You remember that. Good
yes.
trivia.
Yes.
That's my executive summary. What happened is it got put in a warehouse never to be seen again and buried us. I can say that still with a little angst. Welcome to the world of being an entrepreneur and big company bullies that bury you. So we can talk about leadership all we want, but, you know, there's more of the, you know, invented the wiper blade only to be crushed by the big guy, and that's what happened to us. But that gave us enough money. The team was together. We'd gone, you know, we'd shown that we could commercialize a product in you know, very entrepreneurially, very, a word at Lehigh at the time, in an agile manner. And we were really kind of honing in on what we were good at. We went from clueless to exuberant over moments to now realizing that we were starting all over with a blank piece of paper, and solar care became STC, so no one would call us and see if we put on solar panels anymore or still did the sunscreen product. And STC Technologies is what we ran with from that point forward to reinvent ourselves as a healthcare products company. And I think for entrepreneurs or for business leaders, you're constantly reinventing yourself always. And we had to reinvent ourselves because, you know, we gave our baby away, you know. Mm-hmm. We'd sold our rights off, and we had to do something new. We hadn't made any money. It was all in a future bed of royalties. And then it got buried. But we moved on back to leadership. We were too stubborn, too proud to probably go back to our normal lives because we had to start over. So, you know, what we thought, you know, everybody was like high-fiving us because we, you know, knocked it out of the park and licensed it worldwide to Coppertone and got written up in the Wall Street Journal again, was a reality check that we had a falling out. There were four partners that went to three. We don't even go back to that story because unless you lived with us back then, you didn't know that you had to go from four to three. And they go, oh, that's natural for, you know, for partnerships. It happens in life. You know, 50% of marriages end up in divorce. We're not surprised that happened to you, and we went through that. So while everybody else is sort of saying what great things we did, you know, behind closed doors, we were grinding. I mean, in most companies, early stage, you grind a lot. Mm-hmm. And we were grinding like everybody else with special moments.
Mm-hmm.
But this, you know, what the new team, Bill and Sam and I, did was we defined ourselves as healthcare. And then we proceeded to be very entrepreneurial, to take advantage of that skill set as a team, to take stuff from idea to marketplace. And we were very, very good at that. Sam could make stuff as a PhD chemist. Bill could get premium positioning as a gifted branding guy. And I financed it. We trusted each other. We signed the same personal guarantees, and we went for it. And we each other had each other's backs, and it was a we story. We owned the same amount of stock. We signed the same everything. The outside world just needed a CEO, and I was the outside world CEO. But they were my two partners, and we progressed. You fast forward, we had a number of products that went from an idea. The sunscreen product was gone. You fast forward to when we merged to go public in 2000 with a public company. We went from zero to about $19 million in revenues with a mix of a product to freeze warts. We had products that if you applied for life insurance, they asked you to smoke your heart medication, use cocaine. They took a sample, and we did almost 10 million tests at a very low price, high volume, here in Bethlehem, manufactured these tests, did the test kits. And we had a collection device that we got FDA clearance for testing for drugs of abuse. The company we merged with just happened to have that collection device that we got the rights to and tested for HIV. But we had the same customer, 46% of our revenues in a concentrated business model. Auditors, bankers don't like concentration, but most startup companies are betting on one customer all the time. And we all know we can't count on that customer. We don't want to depend on that one customer. We all do, you know, for a long time. So, you know, literally from the time we put the company together in 87 till we licensed our first product in 89, from 1989 till 2000, we merged to go public, we were grinding a lot. And it was 11 years, zero to 19 million in revenues in the peak of the dot-com era. You know, on a transaction that we call related, they were a public company with about $300 million in value. And we called it a relative value calculation. We said, this isn't, you're just going to buy us at a multiple of our revenues. It isn't going to work that way. We've got technology you need. You've got what we need in terms of public market. And so we basically did a what's called relative value. We got 55% of the company in an all-stock transaction with the deal breaker that if you don't move from Portland, Oregon to Bethlehem, we won't cut the deal, because this is where we got started and our roots here in Bethlehem. And I'll give up being the CEO as long as, you know, Bob, you move from Portland and come to Bethlehem to run the combined company. So in an all-stock transaction valued at $255 million to our investors, when we had about, I don't remember the number now, about 100 angel investors who bet on us in the Lehigh Valley over that 11 years, we became a public company, and Orishers on the south side now, and they're well over $100 million in revenues and well-capitalized with, you know, a handful of exciting things going on.
And everyone knows their name. How much, can we go back for a moment, that what happened with Coppertone, putting you in that warehouse, how much did that impact the deals then that you were making with that next joint venture saying, you come from Portland here? Are you trying to control that a little bit now? Did that history that you had impact how you controlled what was going on in the company now?
There's about four questions there, so yeah. Let me break them up down into a couple different parts. In the 90s, in terms of entrepreneurs and the ready, fire, aim side, we make a lot of mistakes, but we're willing and big enough to admit them and fix them. But we rarely make the same mistake twice. So to your point about, you know, is it in the back of your mind? No, it's forefront, and when you cut a deal, you're not going to let that happen. So back to some of the sort of basic business principles we talked to. When it came to Portland, Oregon and Bethlehem, that was a deal breaker, as I said earlier, for us. We got our start in Bethlehem. People took a bet on us, Ben Franklin, the state of Pennsylvania, local angel investors, the economic development community. We were part of a bigger we at a time when Bethlehem Steel was closing down. And, you know, we bought land on an abandoned site on the south side of Bethlehem to be here. And darn it, I wasn't leaving. And, you know, my partners and I weren't leaving. And, you know, we had plenty of ways to raise capital. So the only way it was going to happen if it happened here. So one of the reporters that interviewed me on the morning call at the time and still was with the morning call says, now let me get this right. You bought a public company with their stock at a deal valued for $255 million to your investors and moved headquarters to Bethlehem. Yes. And I'm very, very proud of that.
I love that story, and I love how you really stayed invested then in the Lehigh Valley community. It's like a give and take here. Mm-hmm. You landed here, maybe somewhat by accident, but mm-hmm. it seems when you look back, it's really all on purpose. And some of it may have been luck, some of it may have been planned, but I think it's wonderful that it has gone this way.
I do call it divine intervention typically in a lot of presentations because it's just not textbook.
Yeah.
Just not.
Yeah. Well, it also helps with, I think, having the right people around you. And you have said so many times just in this session that we're having, we. And I believe when you're talking about we and you feel that, then the people around you feel that, and they want to be part of it. And that's what helps make you more successful, I would expect. Everyone's buying in. Part of leadership.
I think so. I hope so.
Yeah.
And it looks that way looking in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So that was your time at Orisure. How did that, how did you segue from Orisure?
Oh, you know, one day, you know,
you were a young man.
I was 46 years old, going on 47. You know, you work 17 years, you don't have a liquidity event. You've been grinding for 17 years with your family. You're not taking much of a salary. And the only way that you really ultimately can set yourself up for life if you're running a public company, because we didn't pay ourselves much, is to leave. And there was this inflection point where the board would say, you know, the bearded guy with the dog under the table that doesn't want to wear the tie, that wants to do the 90-10 rule, you know, and wants to fire all the time, and who doesn't want to sit in meetings, we kind of need, you know, someone that's sort of for this stage of a business. And, you know, you could debate the academics of that inflection point, but divine intervention, blessing in disguise, it was a good thing for everybody. And we were at it. Had great momentum. The company was doing phenomenally well. We were extraordinarily well capitalized. And we were the hottest diagnostics company on the planet. So, you know, if you're going to do a change, what better time to do it? So
you were 46 years old, and did you think about what was next at that point, or did you say, I'm just going to be for a while? Because imagine at this point, you've been going, thinking, grinding for 20 plus years. So at 46, you're seeing this on the horizon. Is it now your thought, I'm just going to be for a while, be at peace for a while? Or is it, what's next?
The complicated question. If you go all the way back to fourth grade when I wanted to buy my first pair of high Converse tennis shoes and I asked my parents for it, they say, if you want a pair of those expensive shoes, go get a job. Well, my first job was delivering Cincinnati Inquirer newspapers, and I had to get up at 4 o'clock every day. So between fourth grade and freshman year in high school, I got up at 4 o'clock every day. So I'm now permanently a 4 o'clock in the morning guy, 5 o'clock in the morning guy. And probably for the last 5 years of Orisure, I was traveling between 200,000 or 300,000 miles on planes. But my family probably only woke up with me in the house, probably, I'm making this up, but 5 days over that 5 years, because office wasn't very far away from our home. First thing in the morning was this way I could get stuff done so I could more or less be always home for dinner if I was in town. I'm still hardwired to be up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and deal with crises, and I like being crisis manager, as twisted as that sounds. And there weren't crises. You know, there was helping my wife clean the house. You know, if I use the most extreme version of gag me,
right.
This just wasn't going to work. Yeah. Love my wife, love my son, you know, bought the dummy's guide to being a soccer coach. Did some of that. We built a lake house and took the summers and did that. But, you know, there was definitely this pent up, I miss the action. And, you know, I love my family, but.
Yeah.
what drives me, you know, there's the next chapter needs to be started on my business life. And it wasn't going to be quietly, philanthropically, where I could sort of just turn it off, not even close.
Do you think it comes from wanting challenge, or do you think there's an element of creativity or curiosity? And if it's any of those or all of those, can you kind of put that together for me? What drives you? What kept you wanting to go on? Challenge, curiosity, creativity? What one speaks to you the most?
Not sure. I think that the idea that you have an idea and you're going to take it to market, and, you know, is it a highly differentiated product in an emerging category with a good leadership team, and you're just going to go for it. And all of a sudden, I get really energized by the passion of doing the unknown around a product, mm-hmm. commercializing it. And those were things that I missed the most. I didn't miss being a public company CEO and the stock price went 13-3. Not only did that negatively impact my own net worth substantially, and we were still hitting every number we wanted, but you know, there wasn't a safe place in the community from someone saying, instead of buying a mattress for my daughter, I bought $100 of your stock and now it's only worth 50. What'd you do to harm me? I didn't care for that part of the public life, because I was being judged every day on a stock price performance instead of my character in terms of the results we got. Because if there was an adjustment in the market, you know, so what? You adjust with the market. And we went through the dot-com crash and all the implications of that. And as survivors, just like we did with the sunscreen product, we reinvented ourselves, we regrinded, and we got back on top of our game. And that was kind of, frankly, as good as it gets to sort of say we can beat all the odds makers. And, you know, now I'm not, you know, beating the odds makers. So it's time to do that again.
So your passion is driven from bringing a product to market. I think it's going to be a little bit more than that. And we're going to talk about some of the additional opportunities you've taken upon yourself with the community, the Lehigh Valley in particular, moving forward with your next venture, Originate Ventures. And then I hope that we're going to talk about some of the lessons that we want to leave with our listeners, lessons with leaders. Folks, we're talking to Mike Gosling, co-founder and managing partner of Originate Ventures. That's what we'll talk about coming up next. Be back in a minute.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
For over 40 years, Godfrey Daniels has presented a fine variety of folk and acoustic music on Bethlehem's South Side. Listen to Live from Godfrey Daniels as we bring you in the door and put you right in the front row with recordings of your favorite shows, plus lots of studio cuts from Godfrey's artists past, present, and future. Join us Tuesday evenings from 7 to 9 for Live from Godfrey Daniels on WDIY.
Welcome back. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse, a special session on Lessons with Leaders. I have with me this evening Mike Gosling, co-founder and managing partner of Originate Ventures, former CEO of Orisure Technologies. We've been going through some of Mike's journey to where he is today. We've talked about his childhood, his startup company, his time at OraSure. And most recently, Mike, you became involved, co-founded, in fact, a venture fund called Originate Ventures, which is on the south side of Bethlehem in the former Bethlehem Firehouse, Bethlehem Steel Firehouse, I believe, and it's called Victory Firehouse. So what is Originate Ventures, and what inspired you to pursue this new venture?
Well, when we went off the last segment, clearly I missed being in the mix of early stage technology companies, and I decided after looking at a lot of different options that I wanted to be in the venture capital business, invest in people that looked and smelled like my partners and I in the previous one, bet on early stage technology companies with a highly differentiated product in emerging markets with a good leadership team with early customers in place if we could. So went back to the same set of angel investors in the Lehigh Valley who had bet on us in our previous life. Ended up raising a little over $30 million locally. And then a year later with a third partner, and I'm one of three partners, back to we. I've got two great partners in this. We ended up raising $46 million to make early stage bets in 2007, same time the stock market crashed. So here we are, fresh with capital, do early stage ideas and come to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, in what used to be Bethlehem Steel's number one warehouse or firehouse. If you're seeking capital between $1 and $4 million as the first institutional investor in your business. In 1 year, we said we got over 1,000 business plans, met 250 companies, and cut three deals. It's a lot of kissing frogs to find, the princess kind of thing, or prince, I guess, the other way. But we placed 17 bets, spent a little over $40 million over the last 6 years on early stage technology companies, mostly pre-revenue. And I'm proud to say, if you fast forward, those companies, and on average, we have roughly $4 million in and own roughly 20% of the company. We don't run any of them. We're just large shareholders and hope we're mentors to help them grow. And revenues are over $225 million with our portfolio now, mostly from startups. So our first company went public a couple months ago, so that was real exciting for us. And it's fun to see, other companies that we seeded the capital and bet on their ideas come true. Now, out of the first 11, there were three or four flaming burnouts that you look backwards and say, why'd you place that bet? And we do high-risk stuff, and we chase dreams.
Well, you ready, fire, aim.
with a heavy emphasis in ready.
And you can enjoy some of those Bob Barker moments.
Absolutely.
Through
other people.
Yeah, which is wonderful. And then it gives them those moments too. I think it's wonderful and fascinating that you really went full circle there. I think that's great. Now, you've been in the Lehigh Valley for 29 years now. You got a great start here, a lot of we going on. And with that, you have also now become more involved even beyond your Originate Ventures, which is providing that capital, providing that ventures to new startups and businesses. You're doing more than just that. You're also doing a lot of volunteer work now. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about some of the organizations you're involved with? I know you're involved with the Community Action Committee and the Lehigh Valley Industrial Park. Would you share with us a little bit about those organizations, why you're involved, and what you hope to accomplish by participating with them?
Sure. This wasn't a binary switch from the day that we started our company here and other people bet on us. We, and particularly me, said this community has bet on us. We have to give back. So there's always been giving back. My ground rules for being involved was I never went to meetings at night. I would only go to a board that was during the day or first thing in the morning because I was going to go home at night. So there were some ground rules early with me in terms of getting involved. But I did the classic Chamber of Commerce Board and YMCA, and, there's a slew of lists of 15 or probably 10 or so that I did. But if you fast forward to where we are today, how can I make the biggest impact? I really got myself down to where I was only willing to do two and then try to be as high impact in a we situation as I could. And that's no particular order, Community Action Committee of the Lehigh Valley. Alan Jennings, this community knows that this community activist, and we couldn't be more opposite in terms of capitalism and, at the core for two people looking at us, but he's a dear friend and he's got a heart that's amazing for helping the poor and the organization that he has and the staff that he has. And we just closed, I'm the treasurer. It's a $23 million organization. We deliver 8.6 million pounds of food. We help people get loans. We do things that are extraordinary to help the most needy in the Lehigh Valley under Alan's leadership. And it's an honor to be involved with them. And where's my skill set? I'm a financially oriented entrepreneur. And if I can help serve that organization in my little small role as a treasurer, then great. Because this is an organization that just makes a huge difference in helping those that need it the most. LVIP, I've been on the board for about 10 years, Lehigh Valley Industrial Park. We've done 7 industrial parks over what I think is roughly 55 years in the Lehigh Valley. Iconic people, roads and highways named after some of these people that have been, in this organization. But you go back to the days of LVIP and its founding back 55 years ago was we need to diversify the work base in the Lehigh Valley and not count 100% on Bethlehem Steel. So the visionary part, which is amazing, the visionary part 55 plus years ago to buy some land up north of the airport and put the infrastructure in place so small businesses could have a plot of ground they could have put a shovel in and moved to the Lehigh Valley. We're now in our 7th park. And that park is over 1,000 acres of, Bethlehem Steel property that at one time was the largest brownfield site in the country. And anybody that's grinded through 412 corridor now knows it's wide open for business to get from 412 into town. And LVIP is actively developing that corridor. LVIP 7, and as we like to say, is $100 million of capital infrastructure cost. And we hope to bring $1 billion of economic, value to the Lehigh Valley and 10,000 jobs. And I've been honored to be with that group under Kerry Robles' leadership and Jeff Feather as the chairman for 10 years, and even more honored to get the chance to be chairman this past year.
So does all of it come together, Mike, with the Lehigh University, the Ben Franklin incubator, for so to speak, your Originate Ventures? You're bringing all of these entrepreneurial ideas, people, and the people who support them. Does it kind of all come together through the Lehigh Valley Industrial Park, or is that more making the space available?
It's all about economic development in the community in which we live, and economic development goes from the place that, we'd like people to be able to feed their families and own a home to, generating, getting new companies to come to the Valley that's going to hire people and let them have their own home and buy their own car. And it's a domino effect, and they're kind of two different ends of the spectrum. But for me, it's all about economic development in the Valley in which I live and job creation. I mean, that's sort of my central theme. I've also been fortunate, in this Valley, again, back to the we. And I'll pick there's hundreds of people that have influenced me in terms of mentoring. But, there's two guys that I like to sort of say that have been my peer group that I've just watched that, different ways have impacted the Valley. J.B. Riley and Scott Fainer. I mean, in 1991, I met J.B. Riley because my wife, future wife, had gone to Notre Dame with his wife, and he aspired to build a business, and I was aspiring to build a business. And he had a friend named, Scott Fainer, who was a DeSales University guy. And I got energized by guys like that that were my peers, that were way outside the box, high impact, highly dedicated to this community. While I was seeing economic development everywhere help us. So I've been fortunate enough, and then have people like Jeff Feather and Hank Barnett and, Chad Paul, guys like that that have been mentors and friends to mine that have said, it's our time. It's time to step up. And frankly, we're at a time now where, we gotta find those next group of leaders that want to step up and think outside the box and, you know, really make the Lehigh Valley what it needs to be for the next generation as well. So, you know, that's kind of, too much is given, much is expected to return, darn it. Yeah. And that's what we're doing.
Yeah, but there's so much energy involved in that, too. It continues to feed, and it's a wonderful opportunity that you've given up-and-coming people in our community as well, and a way of giving back. So that's been wonderful. Mike, what I'd like to do with our Lessons with Leaders segment here is to finish up with some what I'm going to call quick time questions. It doesn't mean you have to rapid fire answers back to me, but I'd like to have the opportunity to get several questions out to you that we can kind of cover fairly quickly. So let's start with describing yourself in a Twitter size way.
Early stage financially oriented entrepreneur is what everybody would expect. I hope that eventually it says good father, trusted him completely, and God-fearing.
Wonderful. What about the most memorable event in your career in the Lehigh Valley?
My son opening NASDAQ market for World AIDS Day would be first.
How old was he at the time? Do you remember?
Seven, I believe.
Oh, that must have been a moment.
They said, we were there. They said, we don't do that. And I said, well, we are. And they found a stool so my son's head could be above the podium so he could do it. And he hadn't learned cursor yet. And your name ends up on cursor on Times Square after that. And it was kind of fun to see my son's first version of cursive on.
Does he recall the moment?
He just says, whatever, Dad, you know.
So. Yeah, that's wonderful, though, but it's a great moment for you, just as we've talked
many
about
ways.
Moments.
For our company, you know, about the product that we had and the validation, back to special moments, validation of the market. And, you know, for me, you know, to just put my family front and center on that, that was great.
That's wonderful. Any childhood story that affected you today?
I drifted at it earlier. My parents said it. My dad, if you want those expensive Converse tennis shoes, go get your first job. It made me fiercely independent early. You want to go to college, you're on your own. So I paid for it. I found it. I visited them on my own. But that first job for the Converse, if you want something bad enough, you just go get it.
Well, you mentioned independent. It also is quite empowering as well, isn't it?
Maybe in the rearview mirror, yes, but yeah, I didn't think so at the time. But
that's why we have to sometimes understand the moments we're in, that they could
or
mean something
else,
later.
Somebody else describe us,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. If you could pick a different career, what would it be?
Architect.
Oh,
I like a blank piece of paper and building things. For those that go to the south side of Bethlehem, whether you like the architecture or not, I came in with a sketch of Tech 2 and said to the city, you build this building, my partners and I will come to the south side of Bethlehem. My partners and I own Tech 3 next door. We put that up with money willing to do character lending from the Lehigh Valley. And then when I left Orchard, I bought the abandoned, it hadn't been renovated firehouse. And it's the most financially irresponsible project I ever did, the firehouse. But those that go by that corner, the before and after are profound. And I'm proud that in our little way, I could anchor that corner as, you know, my would-be architect.
Wonderful. So the Victory Firehouse is on what corner?
It's the corner of Webster, and I guess that's second.
Okay, wonderful. So people could
right next door. Sure, if you're heading down, going down to a music fest event, you see the Victory Firehouse. You go, what goes on in there?
And now they know. Now they know. That's great. How did you learn from a setback? Now we've discussed that a bit.
The 90-10 rule. We learned, you know, we ready, fire, aim, but we learn from our mistakes. You didn't make the same mistake twice, and then you just put your head down and grind it some more.
Right. How would your staff or employees or even maybe your family describe you? And you can pick one or all of those.
staff, employees, same thing. In the Orchard days, every employee, once you got a year with the company, got stock in the company to go forward. So everybody was an owner. We had a company meeting once a month that all employees came to. We put out, you know, bagels and breakfast stuff. And I had up on the wall, my partners and I say, you know, these are the topics we want to talk to everybody about. What else do you want on the board? And we were very transparent. We were a very casual environment. We tried to tell them what we could. It got more complicated when we were public. And we made them owners. But after I left, people said, we would have followed you blindly up a hill, but we're tired.
Well, you have a lot of energy.
Yeah, we do.
So I could see where
someone... started pretty early in the morning,
too. Someone might get tired following behind really you up that hill, because you're probably already up at the top. And what about your family?
That's a tricky one now. My son, who, you know, is a junior in college, we get along great, but he's a junior in college. So everybody's got your own version of your for your listeners to sort of say, you know, how it is to have, you know, a new independent 22-year-old. And it's wonderful to watch him go through that.
Your parents, are they still alive?
My mom, and she's a big, strong believer in what we're doing and, you know, always re-encouraging me.
And your siblings?
You know, they never understand what Mike does. It's sort of back to that, you know, he's just crazy. He does what he does.
Well, you're the oldest child, and
oldest
so
child.
You are what they all have to follow.
Right.
I have to tell you, my oldest brother was a huge influence on our family.
Okay.
You know, the oldest of six children and the first to go to college and quite successful and no competition from his part at all. It was just wonderful. So you, as an oldest child, have more influence and more impact on your younger siblings than you might ever realize.
Unless you're always compared.
Well, you know.
It gets tricky.
That's kind of good, too. A little competition's all right. What do you do for fun outside of work?
Hike and bike and golf are sort of the three things that I like to do. 2016 was a transitional year for me in many, many ways. Hiked 95 miles in the Alps, biked from Pittsburgh to Washington 329 miles in 5 days, and played at least my age in rounds of golf last year. So, you know, that's the kind of mix that up with, with cell phones, and I don't run anything directly anymore. I'm never disconnected, but you can do it virtually. It's a brand new world for, you know, now than versus when, you know, I ran a business.
We have a minute left. How would you like to end with our listeners? What would be your last takeaways?
Well, thanks for having me here today. It's an honor to have lived the American dream in the Lehigh Valley, and in particular in Bethlehem. And, you know, wherever the adage came up that, you know, the Lehigh Valley, you know, when we tried to recruit people, the community did, you know, it's a great place to work, live, and raise your family. It's been an amazing place for me for all three of those.
Well, we have obviously benefited from you being here in the Lehigh Valley community, and we thank you for your journey and letting us be part of it. Thank you so much for being here, Mike. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mike Gosling, our guest this evening, thank you for being here and to share your lessons on leadership.